Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Oscar for Best Theme for a Radio Program goes to Elena Katz-Chernin for The Russian Rag. It is still deeply controversial. Today I got a couple of emails from people saying that they're tempted to turn off during the theme. They hate it so much. I tried to Australianise it by retitling it The Waltz of the Wombats. Don't send me 20 emails saying it's not a waltz. I know it's a foxtrot. But Waltz of the Wombats goes nicely. But it's got me into trouble because last week I was telling far-flung listeners, poddies in other lands, about the wombat in response to queries, explaining that the wombat is a member of the bat family, and by huffing and puffing, by a form of hyperinflation, bobs around in the treetops, goes around in the canopies of the eucalypts like a little furry balloon. This has been contested. There are people saying that I am misleading the young. So later on in the week we shall have a couple of wombat experts who will come on and validate my claims of its aeronautic abilities. I always end the week by thanking the team, as you know. This week I begin by complaining about them. It turns out there's been a bloody change of government in Canberra. Why am I the last to know? Fortunately, we've got the services in just a moment of Laura Tingle, who's going to fill me in on this remarkable and, I must say, thoroughly alarming event. Laura gets around Canberra with her own rubber plant. She plonks it down in rooms in the hallways, hides behind it and eavesdrops. So she gets all the dirt. Now, Laura, she will untangle Canberra, Laura Tingle. Then we're going to look at the psychology. Yes, psychology of climate change. Soon it'll be climate change and psychoanalysis, won't it? But tonight it's psychology. And then we're going to look at a musical called The Hatpin, of which I've seen just a smidgen on the telly. Extraordinarily interesting, and it tells a strange and very sad story. Laura Tingle, tell me, who won the election?
Somebody they thought was John Howard, but less frightening, Philip, Kevin Rudd.
Oh, heavens above. Now, I want you to tell me about the goings-on in the bear pit later, but first of all, Ross Garner's been a bit naughty, hasn't he? Hasn't he written an even more dramatic report than any government could be comfortable with?
He's written a slightly different script, Philip. Most of the listeners to Late Night Live would have heard a bit about Ross Garnaut's interim report on climate change last week, and that was focusing, the headlines were focusing on the fact that he's saying that you've got to do essentially twice as much as the government had committed to in terms of cutting back on emissions trading. But his report actually is even more complicated and challenging, I think, for the government and the community than that. The Howard government had essentially proposed that all the existing big emitters would be given a sort of a get-out-of-jail card, if you like. They'd be given licences to emit as much as they currently are as a start-up to the system. Ross Garnaut has come out and said, well, why should they? They should have been thinking about this years ago, and so they should have to pay for their emission licences. Now,
good on him. Go for the throat, Garnaut.
That's right, but which is a very noble. But it really, I suppose, is starting to dawn on the glitterati in Canberra what emissions trading and really dealing with climate change is going to mean politically. And I suppose at the moment you've got this sort of dichotomy in Canberra between, that's not the right word, but you've got this split anyway between the government really behind the scenes starting to wrestle with some very complicated issues of political management and policy, and then you've got a bit of a sort of low farce on the surface. And I think ministers are now just starting to say, OK, if we start an emissions trading system in 2 years' time, what's going to actually happen to the economy when we do that? I mean, nobody's suggesting it will flatline, but if you think about all the sorts of knock-on effects and perverse effects that you're likely to get when the price of energies start to change, it's going to be quite a fascinating and tricky time. If you think about how
fascinating, yes, tricky, yes, but what a wonderful challenge for a nation to face.
Absolutely, and it's going to be a huge new debate, which really hasn't started yet. And I suppose you could argue on the question of him saying that the rate of cut should be twice as much as the government has said. If you're a cynic, you could say, well, I don't suggest he's doing this for this reason, but in some ways, by putting the barrier that far out, what the government's suggesting is sounding relatively reasonable and moderate in comparison.
We're going to make our contribution on the program by eliminating any hint of right-wing politics. Finally. You know, we've had a bit in just to make us look pluralist, but we're going to get rid of them all, and that will be our contribution.
Right.
You can stay on.
I was worried where that might be leading to.
Now, from behind your rubber plant, which I understand you actually got into the house proper, not upstairs, you know, you're down on the floor, tell us about all the brawls that have been going on in Kevin Rudd's new kingdom.
Well, we talked a couple of weeks ago, Philip, about these new Friday sittings, and I think I was saying to you at that stage that the risky bit of doing something new in Parliament was nobody was quite sure what would happen as a result. And last Friday we essentially saw that rule prove true. I think the government was... they probably had all sorts of very wise guy type thoughts about what they might be able to do with this backbencher Friday. What they probably didn't assume was that the opposition would muck up so much as they did. So you've now got this situation where the government's saying, look, it's a backbencher's day and you should make the most of it. The opposition saying, no, if Parliament's there, all the ministers should be there, which I think, frankly, is a bit of a silly proposition because the Parliament does not revolve around the executive. And we had this stunt where the opposition's trying to use the absence of ministers to suggest that Kevin Rudd is lazy or that that he's somehow not being accountable. Now, and then also a suggestion that somehow it's unconstitutional. Now, some of this might rub off, but I don't think all of that footage that people would have seen on their television of the cardboard cutouts, and it was quite witty, but I think people get a bit irritated by it, so it's probably ended up...
Hang on, I'll just conduct a poll. Hands up all the gladdies and the potties who were irritated by it. Oh, look at that. I think the eyes have it. I think the eyes have it. Yeah. Go to the left of the chair. And the others. No, the eyes have it.
No, so I think it ends up washing up badly on both sides of politics, and it's going to keep going because they've delayed all the votes on whether people should be thrown out and everything else.
Wasn't the Liberal parties, the opposition parties, undermined just a little by those remarkable images of Lord Downer wallowing in luxury in a restaurant?
With Greg Sheridan of The Australian to boot.
Yes, there you go. Did he boot him?
No, it was probably just...
No. Surely that would have, you know, that sort of made the farce even more farcical.
Well, I think the fact that he was out to lunch sort of highlighted the fact that you've got this the old boys sitting up in the back row all looking like they'd rather be having their toenails pulled out. Peter Costello spends his entire time in a fury of tapping on his laptop. The government keeps it.
Are you allowed to do that? You're allowed to sit and tap on your laptop?
Oh, yes. Malcolm Turnbull was a major laptop tapper when he was a backbencher.
Is that right?
Jackie Kelly, it's a bit widespread, but Peter Costello is a absolute he's a centre of all this activity, but none of it's actually directed at what's going on in Parliament.
Tsk. Let me ask you in parenthesis: could you take your rusty trusty Olivetti portable and tap on that, or would that be considered?
Oh no, that would be regarded as unparliamentary.
Right. Okay. Just wanted to know. How exciting these times are in which we dwell.
Well, I suppose we're just getting to this point, though, Philip, where we've had another couple of commissions announced today, and I think people are starting to go, well, can we get on with it and do a few things? I mean, commissions are very good, and yes, you have a lot of them in government, but I'm starting to lose count a bit. I don't know about you.
As a mother who has had to combine a busy parliamentary career with motherhood, did you feel a bit sympathetic to the Rudds hiring a sort of a sit-in carer for one of the kids?
Well, look, one, I did. Two, I've got to say, I thought all the There's sort of a bit of a double standard about this, Philip. Everybody says, isn't it outrageous because everybody's struggling on childcare, which is true. But I suppose I'd look at it another way. I'd rather that if there was some sort of budget for keeping the Prime Minister in style in Kirribilli, I'd rather it was on spent on childcare than
at the lodge, or something.
Yeah. But as it turns out, the PM says he'll pay that cost himself.
Circling back to the good Professor Garnaut, is he now hated and loathed and feared by the Rudd government rather than welcomed?
I don't think so. I think most of the ministry understands how complicated this issue is, and they really need somebody out there trying to outline the complexities of the argument. And I think even the way the Garnaut report was reported last week shows that people are just really starting to brush the surface of this. As we said earlier, people were just looking at his recommendations on emissions trading. There was a lot more that he had to say about a whole range of issues. And if people think about something as simple as the price of petrol for their cars and the fact that they may have to start paying more for it in the future in passed on costs from petrol producers, it just starts to focus your mind on how complicated this is.
So I think by the end of the year, the Rudd government will have got rid of the petrol-driven car. It'll be easy. They'll hydrogen or something by Christmas. That's my bet. Laura, we've got to go. We've got another story on climate change coming up in just a minute. Thank you very much for Laura's view from behind the Aspidistra, Chief Political Correspondent for the Australian Financial Review. This is LNL on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, downloadable onto your pod. Music Maestro. Over the years, indeed the decades, we've discussed climate change from every vantage point. We've had, of course, physicists and chemists and geologists and engineers. Even theologians have popped in to chat about it. I was always most amused by the Bible bashers, the God botherers, because, as you know, the good book puts forward the proposition that the world is here to pleasure us and we're to do with God's creatures what we will. And, of course, the American fundamentalists took the view that the planet was was rapidly approaching. Come the rapture, we just shrug it off like an old overcoat. And there were people, of course, in the Reagan government, a very famous Secretary of the Interior, who believed we should mine all the national parks because, the end times were upon us and what the hell. Lately, theologians, we've had a few on the program, have discovered hidden in the biblical text, the Old Testament, warning notes, and they found that Jesus was a greenie. I can't see it myself, but I'm willing to be persuaded. But tonight, we're going to look at climate change through the prism of psychology. Oh, there was a huge response last week to our climate change story on democracy, the idea put forward by Dr. David Shearman, that it may well require an authoritarian form of government with policy determined by scientific experts to face up to the threat before it is too late. David argued that democratic government subject to popular opinion, the power of markets, corporations, politicians with short time frames and anxieties about elections are incapable of making the urgent decisions necessary. The latest official report, as you've just heard, written for the Rudd government by Russ Garnaut, simply adds to the pile of previous scientific and economic analyses, and it's receiving, shall we say, a low-key, if not faintly horrified, response from the government. Of course, one of the greatest challenges is shifting behaviour, whether as an industry or an individual, and it seems little attention has been paid at the strategic level to psychological motivations that would drive change. Next week, psychoanalysis, tonight, psychology. We're going to look beyond the science and the economics and ask how much governments and political leaders understand of the psychology around climate change. Two guests in the Canberra studio, Jason Mazanoff, who's a lecturer in the School of Business with the UN University of New South Wales at the Australian Defence Force Academy, one of the very few psychologists writing about this in Australia. And back on the program, on the blower from London, Simon Retallack, who's the head of the climate change team at the British think tank, the Institute for Public Policy Research. And listeners will remember Simon from a recent discussion about climate change and what was dubbed climate change porn. Simon, Jason, welcome to our little program, which, although it's called Late Night Live, is powered by solar panels. Jason, lots of scientists and economists are making substantial contributions to the climate change debate. As I said, even theologians. Where have the psychologists been?
Psychologists have been looking at all sorts of things, but I think a lot of them have not been focused directly on the question. There's papers going back as far as 2000 looking at how psychology can help for a sustainable human future, but they tend to look at things which don't really, I guess, fit into that environmental porn that you were talking about, that green porn.
Jason, the environmental scientist tries to appeal to the rational mind, the weight of evidence. The economist will say that a market puts a dollar value on the environment, that'll help people change. Both are, well, allegedly rational responses. Psychology doesn't deal necessarily with the rational, does it?
That's right, and certainly there's actually a paper which has been recently published by Etkin and Ho, which says that the mathematics underlying our climate change behaviour is non-linear. That is, it's non-rational. And so this idea of trying to approach things from people's perspective of emotion and habit and so on is becoming more and more of an issue. We see it in Australia, I think, with when the Stern report was released, there was near hysteria about climate change and we have to do something because it correlated with a particularly hot, dry spell. And now that things are a little bit wetter in certain parts of the country, people are relaxed a bit more.
Almost 30 years ago, I started writing on this, and I was talking at the time about the religiosity, even then, of what was then the global warming movement. And it seemed to me that there was already a very, very big emotional, irrational ingredient in the emerging debate. One of them was a sort of one of them was clearly guilt, and the other was a sort of fatalism tinged with a millenarian pleasure that we were being, you know, severely punished. So there's always been a deep emotional conflict, has there not, within this issue?
I think there is, because there's so many conflicting things, one of which the economists quite enjoy, the self-interest motive, where we like to do things which make us feel good. And a lot of the things that we might be seeing in terms of what we have to do about climate change is decidedly uncomfortable. We may have to drive less. We may have to travel on those wonderful status-providing flights overseas less. That's actually how I came into the idea of psychology and climate change, was to look at the psychology of climate change as what we call a discretionary health risk behaviour. So that's things like...
Okay, before I bring Simon in, talk to that just for a minute or two.
The discretionary health risk behaviour idea is that people smoke. They know it's bad for them, but they do it anyway for a myriad of reasons. People start off as non-smokers and they become smokers. And we know that we should stop. It's good for us to stop, but we just don't want to do it because some people just really enjoy smoking. It makes them feel really good.
Oh, I used to love it. You're not allowed to at the ABC. They attack you with cattle prods.
Other people enjoy eating and so on. Some people seem to derive some pleasure from driving without a seatbelt, which
even
completely mystifies
me. Even
sex.
Some people seem to enjoy sex.
Funny that. But the thing is that with sex in particular, you've got the problem of sexually transmitted diseases, which are again sort of posing a problem for Australia.
So here we've got, in other words, there's always a rational issue and we irrationally manage to ignore it.
Yeah, pretty much. And it's that side of how do we actually convince people to do something that's good for them in the end rather than just the individual but maybe for the planet as a whole. We've done it with other public health things. There seems to be a very strong, as you mentioned, antisocial element now to smoking in Australia, which doesn't exist in other countries overseas yet. But It's on the way, and we've done it with things like drink driving, and certainly the we all remember the Grim Reaper ads. They had a big effect.
They were total nonsense, of course. I hated the Grim Reaper ads. Talk about a huge amount of disinformation being peddled, but let's not get stuck into that. Okay, now, Jason, let's bring Simon back, because Simon's a fascinating fella, and I want to ask you this question, Simon. Roughly what proportion of Britain's carbon emissions come from recalcitrant individuals rather than from industry?
It's a good question. It's almost half. It's about 45% of the UK's carbon dioxide emissions that come from choices that individuals and households make. That's the sort of stuff that you can measure, from using gas and electricity in your house to using petrol in your car and flying. It doesn't actually include things that are harder to measure, like the carbon contribution of the product that you might buy that's been imported from overseas. So,
like bottled water or what have you, yeah.
Yeah, so it's likely to be more than that, but it's significant. And so obviously, any solution from a policy-making point of view to climate change needs to factor in behaviour change, because it's such a big part of the problem.
Now, Simon, then there's the gap between what we say about climate change and what we do. I talk like Savonarola, but I behave like Bacchus. This is a pretty wide gap, isn't it?
There's a huge gap, unfortunately. It's of course, hugely welcome that there's been a real sea change in attitudes towards the problem, and people now, when they're questioned in surveys, certainly in Europe, are very keen to let questioners know that, yes, they take climate change very seriously, it's a major problem. But when it comes to looking at what they're doing, it's quite depressing. A tiny percentage of all new cars sold in the UK last year were so-called hybrid cars that use less petrol. Under 0.5% of the population has any form of microgeneration in their homes. I could go on.
Public transport is still pretty pitiful, isn't it? I think it's only 8% of the total number of trips made in your country.
Yes, it is, something like that. So, in other words, all the sorts of climate-friendly behaviours that we want people to adopt are only being adopted by a very, very tiny proportion of the population, even though vast majorities in opinion polls say they think that that climate change is a serious problem that needs resolving. So confronted with that problem, you have to ask yourself, has the traditional approach taken by government to achieving behavior change worked? Traditionally, people have thought in government, all you need to do is give the public more and more information about a problem and send the right price signals, and they will act rationally and they will change their behavior. They'll see the truth and they'll see what's in their economic interest and change. Well, we've seen that that just hasn't worked here. And it's for all the reasons that you've just been discussing. It's because people ultimately aren't rational, and they have all sorts of other both internal and external influences on behavior, from psychological motivation, status-seeking, wanting to form identity, emotions, habits. Also, social norms play a really big role. What other people do. We all like to feel normal amongst our peers. And if a particular behavior we're asking people to adopt is pretty unusual and not that normal, we feel a bit uncomfortable. Knowing all that enables you to design a whole raft of policy interventions that actually are much more likely to be effective.
This is LNL, solar-powered, although it's on at night. It's on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, downloadable onto your pod or your pedal radio. And I'm talking about climate change psychology with Simon Retallack in London and Jason Mazanoff in Canberra. Jason, in an earlier careers, I worked a lot in what was known as societal marketing, trying to affect attitude change and behaviour change in Australia on a whole range of activities. You're too young to remember it, but Late Night Live was one of mine, or Slip, Slap, Slop, which I think is still running as a way of conning people, amusing them into being careful about, skin cancers. We did campaigns on racism, all sorts of stuff. In every case, we had psychologists helping us nut out the strategy. These days, are psychologists being brought into this particular emergency to help map strategies?
Part of the I put an article together for the Australian Psychological Society Insight magazine, which addressed that question. There's a lot of money at the moment which is going towards the physical sciences and economics now to try and address this issue of climate change. But I've in my efforts to try and secure funding, I haven't been able to find anything which actually supports a much broader social science approach to the climate change issue.
And yet, Simon, governments are used to it in areas like road safety. They're used to, they've long ago realised that you need psychological strategies to produce effective advertising campaigns that might modify behaviour, because just haranguing people or lecturing them or giving them facts never works.
It's interesting that government has got it right in road safety issues. It's true here in the UK, and I'm sure it's true elsewhere. And yet that knowledge and that sort of skill base hasn't been transferred to other areas. It's beginning to happen over here, but because people have realised that it just hasn't worked. In fact, bombarding people with bad news stories can be counterproductive. It can increase people's sense of concern, but also increase people's sense of helplessness.
That's right. Helplessness, fatalism, what the hell, live, laugh and be happy because tomorrow we die.
That's exactly right. And in the end, what we've seen is this massive bystander effect in psychology where, you know, so many people are contributing to the problem, but because there are so many people involved, they think someone else will deal with it. And so what you get is sort of a mass paralysis where no one does anything. And of course, the fewer people act, the more people think there's no problem. They think, well, if there was a problem, surely people would be doing something.
But Simon Retallack, there must be oases, however, of intelligence in the UK where good work, good research, good psychological analysis is being done.
Well, we hope so. We believe that our own Institute for Public Policy Research has contributed to this field to a very modest degree, and we've certainly been pushing our own government to look at this very carefully. And actually, I'm pleased to say that our Department for the Environment is now acting on some of these findings and developing a more sophisticated approach to ensure that the sort of climate-friendly behaviours we'd like the public to adopt meet the requirements for behaviour change so that, for example, they are attractive to people, because we know people like to have a car or an electrical item that's attractive because they're interested in social status and identity. Equally, rewards can play a role in attracting people to adopt the right sorts of behaviours. Group support, because people need support, their peers in all of this, as well as something we call social proofing, so that in the community...
Sorry, something you call what? Would you repeat that?
Social proofing, climate-friendly behaviours, so that... You know, for example, take solar panel or small-scale wind. You could have it in schools, in hospitals, where they're hubs of the community. People can see that these things work, that they're normal, and therefore they begin to increase their legitimacy and attractiveness, if you like, to the ordinary average citizen.
Simon, one of the things that we have in our country, and I'm sure you have it in yours, is that children, little kids, one's own, become like the Red Guard, and they nag and nag and nag and nag. I mean, I still love sitting on the veranda, rolling a cigarette, because the roll is the only way to smoke. And my daughter would go, nag, 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 and now I can't get away with it. And every child I know is a little crusader on climate change. But that drives you nuts finally, doesn't it?
Well, it's a very valuable aspect of the solution. I think education and the engagement of young people is critical. The problem we found, though, is that it's children under the age of 12 that are most responsive to issues.
Which is an argument for contraception and reducing the human population level.
Well, that's a whole other debate, slightly more controversial. But the challenge is with teenagers who become rampant consumers and don't want to know about all of this stuff. So,
I see. You're making the point that after puberty, you just say, gimme, I want all the toys.
That's it. Now, what do we do about that?
And they all look at that program from England on motor cars, which is becoming a Top Gear. It's now becoming a sensational success in Australia. Jason, is it possible to model psychological responses in the way that climate change scientists use modelling or economists use models? Do you have models?
It's certainly something that psychology is moving towards more and more. I'm actually working with some electrical engineers who look at systems dynamics modelling, and we're actually trying to develop a mental model of people's water use behaviour in Canberra. PhD student Sondos is working with me, and really what that's about is developing a mental model, working out where the weights lie and the relationship between various bits and pieces, and have a framework of beliefs that actually lead to behaviour. Psychology is beginning to catch up with the other social sciences in the sense that we are becoming more mathematically literate and looking at new ways of thinking about the way the brain is constructed.
Simon, last week I had a a lovely fellow on, David Shearman, who's an emeritus professor, a big time medico, and he was making the point to me on the phone yesterday that the Gano report does not factor in the medical costs of climate change, the epidemiological implications. But he is so concerned by the inability of governments to respond to the crisis that he's now worried that democracy is running out of time and that we'll need some form of authoritarianism to formulate policy with the required urgency. From your point of view in GB, how do you feel about that?
Well, it's a very challenging dilemma. We have less than 10 years, really, to stop the growth in CO2 emissions globally. And, of course, the trend is of rising CO2 emissions worldwide. What do you do? Can democracy cope? I think, ultimately, we don't have a choice. Authoritarian solutions are unlikely to work because you need to bring the public with you. And if it's authoritarian, it's
so
not going to have
You need more and better psychology and less, and perhaps hold the authoritarianism.
I agree, definitely.
Okay, well, that was a very vigorous, albeit brief debate. Simon Retallack, head of climate change team at the Institute for Public Policy Research in the UK. We'll be calling on you again, Simon, for your cogent views. And Jason Mazanoff, who's a lecturer in the School of Business at the University of New South Wales, but he's not there. He's at the Australian Defence Force Academy, producing a new generation of brilliant military people who will enforce climate change, well, lower CO2 emissions at the point of a gun. Late Night Live, ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, downloadable onto your pod. Coming up after a bit of music, the fascinating story known as the Hatpin. You know, driving in tonight, dear listener, as I approach the ABC, I go quite close to the Bot Gardens, and there was these thousands and thousands of bats flying over Sydney. And from another part of the park, from another part of the gardens, there were the wombats flying in a different part of Sydney. Not, they don't have wings, but they inflate and they bob about a lot. On the 15th of August, 1893, John Macon was hanged at Darlinghurst Jail for the murder of an infant. And I always go past Darlinghurst Jail on my way in. Macon and his wife Sarah were the notorious pair of baby farmers of 19th century Sydney who spent years moving houses to try and avoid the women who'd entrusted babies into their care. Now, this sounds all very mysterious, but it does, in fact, become a great mystery. Baby farming could be a good temporary solution for mums who had nobody to turn to. But like most things, it developed a dark and unscrupulous side, and nasty characters like Macon, who took in little babies for profit. Now there's a new musical based on the practice of baby farming called The Hatpin. I glimpsed a little bit of it on the telly the other night and found it clearly, this is a class act. This is a fine piece of work. It's based on the true story of Amber Murray, a single mum who advertised for help in looking after a baby in a Sydney newspaper in the hope of saving his life. And I'm joined now from Brisbane by the writer and creator of The Hatpin, James Miller, from Wollongong by Carol Herbin, who's director of the Illawarra Historical Society. While doing her family tree, she discovered she was related to the aforementioned and malevolent Mr. Macon. We had hoped to add to our triumvirate Penny Russell, an associate professor of history from the University of Sydney, but I believe she's out watching wombats dancing in the moonlight. Welcome, James, and welcome to you also, Carol. James,
thank you very much.
James, as I said, I've glimpsed a bit of what you're up to, and I found it compelling. And that word, compelling, why were you compelled to write a musical about such an improbable topic?
Unlikely topic for a musical, I know.
Is it a touch of the Stephen Sondheims, is it?
There is a touch of the Stephen Sondheims about it, yes. But the answer to that is twofold. First of all, I think not only merry stories sing, I think there's a lot of music that can express grief or fear, and Peter Rutherford, the composer, is actually a master at very suspenseful and very touching and moving music, and he wanted to write a dark piece that he thought was important. So I shared the story with him because I think it's a really important piece of Australian history that is largely unknown. So,
James, the thing I found quite alarming is you're both so preposterously young.
Yes, I'm 28 and Pete's 26.
Well, there you go. It's ridiculous. I mean, your voices have hardly broken. Now, tell us about Amber Murray. Why did she need to seek out the services of a baby farmer in the first place?
Well, very little is known actually about Amber Murray herself. It took quite a bit of researching even to find sort of scant information on her. So, largely a lot of stuff within the show I have taken dramatic license with, but Amber Murray herself was a single mother, and the reason she sought out baby farmers, as they were called, but professional carers, as she knew them, was the same reason that a lot of women did, which was there was no welfare for a woman unless she wanted to adopt her child out to an orphanage. She had no way of getting temporary care for a child other than by advertising it in a newspaper column and sort of doing it all herself. So what she would do is Amber Murray advertised in the paper, offered about 10 shillings a week to anyone who would care for her child for a temporary period of time, likely so that she could get back on her feet. And then the Makins then took off with her baby, and she never saw it again. So.
I should point out that this poor fella is talking to me from the theatre where he's rehearsing, or at least from his rehearsal space, which is why he's obviously sounding so stressed. James, what happened when she returned?
Doing a song and dance number.
Have you?
Yeah.
Well, we'll do one together. Look, when she wanted to visit her baby, what happened?
She would knock on the door, and then they would provide an excuse. Either one of the daughters would say, "Mother and father are out with the baby," or there was no answer, or the husband or the Mr. or Mrs. Makin would answer the door and then claim that the baby was out with one or the other, and she, every time she came to the door, she was provided with an excuse. I believe there is a story that happened that at one point a baby was brought to her at the door, basically to keep her quiet, and she said, this is not my child. They presented her with somebody else's child just to make her believe that her child was still there.
Mm. Mm. James, tell me about the title, The Hatpin.
There's a little bit of mystery surrounding the title, so I won't tell you entirely what the
James, please is. Don't tell me what the title of that means.
No, but there's a metaphor that runs through the show with all the women in the show who all hold a dark secret, and the symbol of a black hat on their head, and then removing the hatpin and removing the hat after they release their secret is one of the strong sort of visual metaphors throughout the piece.
Okay, this is LNL on ABC Radio, National Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, downloadable onto your pod. We're discussing The Hatpin with James Miller. James is the wordsmith of the duo, and we're now joined by Carol Herbin, who is director of the Illawarra Historical Society. Oh, and we've found Penny Russell, that's good. Carol, the details about The Hatpin, did they come out before or after the trial?
In November 1892, the theory of long needles or hatpins commenced in 1891 when children found a bloodstained calico piece of rag. In it was five needles. And they'd taken it home to their mother and they'd showed them, but she didn't come forward till 12 months later. And that theory was not used because the babies that John and Sarah went to trial for were the babies that were killed in June and July period of 1892. So this is 1891 that the needles were found. And they went to trial because on the evidence that was produced in the coroner's court.
Carol, how many kids were killed?
14. Very sad, Philip, isn't it?
This is major serial killing, isn't it?
It is.
Did you know from your family history whether the Macons were making a lot of money out of this or was it small change?
They were making money. There was some sort of a rift in the Macon family here in Wollongong in the fact that John and his sister were left their inheritance at £1 a week. And I've never known, I know why. John was in trouble early in the 1870s and 1880s, long before this. He was in trouble with the police and the law and the courts. And probably when Mother died in 1890, she thought that he only deserved it at £1 a week, not his inheritance in bulk. And but Sarah, his wife, was receiving £1 for the confinements of young mothers. And besides that, they were hocking the baby's clothes at pawnbrokers' shops from the babies that had died. So it's very sad.
But it's interesting that when he went to jail, the entire contents of the house were sold for 12 shillings.
Exactly right. So you can imagine how much they shifted every 6 weeks to 2 months from house to house.
Let us now welcome to the embrace of the program Penny Russell, Associate Professor of History at the University of Sydney. Penny, we're using the term baby farming in a very pejorative sense, notorious sense, but it covered other accepted and not entirely sinful practices, didn't it? Like wet nursing.
Well, I think the language in which baby farming, or the way that baby farming was used, changed a lot over those last decades of the 19th century. In the 1870s, people would talk about baby farming to refer to state-supported foster care, to refer to a whole range of foster caring practices. By the time we're talking about here in the 1890s, baby farming had taken on this much more pejorative sense of referring to those unlicensed, unregulated, and what we're seeing increasingly as very dangerous sort of practices.
Did the media take it up as an issue before the Amber Murray story?
I think it had been an issue for many years. The what seems to me to drive a lot of the scandal about baby farming is the concern of a medical profession to get more and more control over what's happening to infants and to children throughout the colonies. The infant mortality rate was very high, was as much as 1 in 5 in late 19th century Australia. And, you know, doctors and philanthropists and welfare workers in general are deeply concerned to try to improve the chances of life for all children by bringing them more within the regulation of the state and the hospitals.
Penny, I'm reminded of more recent events. I'm reminded of when the governments around Australia started to close down institutions for people with mental problems, and they basically shoved them out into the street, and there was no preparation really for them. And God, you know, I used to see these poor characters wandering around King's Cross up here, which is always, of course, like a theme park for human misery. And I mention this because during the 1880s, the state had begun to close its orphanages, hadn't it?
Well, my understanding is that the orphanages at that time were becoming very overcrowded. They were reaching the limits of what they could, of the children they could take in. There was much debate about whether more orphanages should be built, but a strong sense that those sort of big barrack-like institutions were not the place where children should be cared for, and that different sort of family-based foster care systems should be set up. But what the state is doing is setting up, of course, the state children's boarding out systems and bringing the whole system of foster care much more within its own regulation. I think those informal foster caring systems that were termed baby farming existed, you know, alongside the orphanages rather than being something that came into existence only because the orphanages got overcrowded.
Carol Herbin, I must credit statewide with telling the story on television the other night. It's one of my favourite programs, New South Wales Statewide. And one of the most compelling images in it are the photographs of the Makins. And I've got to say, these are faces that chill one to the marrow.
Would you leave your child with them?
I wouldn't leave my worst enemy with them.
No, no.
I mean, these were faces of implacable, well, evils, is a very colourful word, but unpleasantness.
Yes, yes, definitely. John Makin seemed to be a very lazy man. He didn't seem to have much thought or care. Sarah was very volatile and she was a very explosive type person. Nothing for her to curse her own children in the court. So it gives you an idea who was the driving force behind the pair. And they even used, he would go out and say his name was Mr. Hill or McLaughlin or Leslie or these names. And these poor girls were giving up their children to people who thought they were those names. Only when they started to find bodies that these young mothers who were desperate to know what happened to their little children would go to Newtown Police Station and ask, and they'd say it'd be Mr. Leslie or McLaughlin or whatever. And in all the time, it was John and Sarah Makin. But even their children were involved in it. They would bring their children to houses to show people. It was nothing. And their children had to have known, the older children had to have known what practice their mother and father were undertaking. Of course, a child would disappear and there would be a fresh mound of dirt in the backyard.
We're discussing the demon carers of George Street with Carol Herbin, Penny Russell and James Miller. Back to you, James. The plight of Amber Murray, and I know she's the centre to your story, because you want to make this, you want to add some hope and some human dignity to this horror story. When did the plight of her and baby Horace come to the public's attention?
It came to the public's attention in 1892 when the bodies were found. Drainer named James Sinoni was digging in the yard of the Burren Street residence of the Makin family, because I think Carol can confirm this, a water tank on the rail line there had leaked into the yard, and the drainer was sent just to clean that up after they had left the house. So when he started digging, he unearthed a couple of bundles, small white bundles, and then at that point it is believed that Amber Murray was one of the mothers that put her hand up and said, one of those children is mine, and then had to go through the horrible task of not only grieving her child but being forced in public to identify it in a court of law and prove that it was her own child, while being shamed for being a single mother out of wedlock. So,
and you find in her story some admirable human qualities, don't you, in the woman herself?
Yeah, I think there's a wonderful story there about someone in a very tough time who hits rock bottom and found a way out. I mean, the woman continued to live on and have a family, it is believed. And I think it's an amazing thing to be a lone woman in 1892 Australia who is shamed for having a child, then has to suffer the grief of losing the child, then has to suffer the humiliation in front of the media and the public and the court at the time of identifying it. I think there's a great story of triumph and hope within that very sort of sad world that she lived in.
Penny Russell, did the sensational story of the babies' corpses found at Redfern and Macdonaldtown lead the government to introduce that first Child Protection Act, or was that coincidental?
Well, there'd been an Infant Protection Act introduced in Britain in 1872, which was inspired by a sensational baby farming case. In the colonies, they started to come in about 1890. At different times in different colonies. But my sense is that concern about infant protection was well and truly in place. And that the Makin case was rather used to drum up
you know, a higher level of popular support.
I think you've made the point elsewhere that perhaps the Child Protection Act was aimed more at older vagrant kids who were neglected and drawn to criminality.
No, I think that was that's a slight confusion that I had earlier. There was a Neglected and Criminal Act which was directed more to juvenile delinquents. The Infant Life Protection Act was very much about enforcing the registration of stillbirths and insisting that, you know, that all deaths of baby infants should be reported to doctors and registered.
Let's go back to Carol, who is an absolutely humane and compassionate descendant. I want to make that point, Carol, that you're lovely. why was the husband prosecutor and not wife Sarah?
I don't know. I suppose it's the period of time that he carried virtually in through the courts, carried the responsibility for his family. And that's the way I looked at it, because I feel that it was Sarah. Sarah was definitely the killer. Sarah was the one that drove this situation. If she was a midwife taking in children and taking young mothers into their homes, I feel that Sarah was the one that had drove this whole situation of baby farming.
And you think that John, being incredibly lazy, you know, was hard-pressed even digging the holes.
That's right. That's right. And as I was going to say to you, there was only two children identified, and that was little Horace Amber Murray, and he was identified by the dress that his mother had handed him over in. She had made one sleeve was longer than the other. The other child was Minuetta Lavinia Davis. She was the daughter of Horace Bothamley and Minnie Davis, and she was identified by her pink and white striped booties. So what those children were wearing was when their mothers saw them for the last time.
We should make the point that Horace was only 9 weeks old when
That's
he
right.
was delivered
yes.
into the tender care of the Makins.
Right.
Okay, James, you're not the composer, which means you can be remarkably objective about the music. What sort of music will the audience hear?
There's a lot of beautiful melody, but the way that Peter Rutherford writes is he gets the lyric first and the story first, and that's the music form out of that. So the music is exceptionally exciting. People have likened it to Philip Glass. It's got that kind of constant surge of tension through it.
And repeated motifs, therefore.
And repeated motifs, yes. And it's particularly dark, particularly exciting, and sort of semi-classical. So it's not show tunes.
Well, I've got to say, James, for decades I complained that Australian musical theatre was, well, virtually non-existent. It was, you know, it was the most undeveloped part of our theatrical activity. Tell me about the scale of it. It's a modest sized production, isn't it?
Yeah, there are 11 actors in it in total. A lot of whom, because there are a lot of characters involved in this story. A lot of whom double up, play different characters. There's an orchestra of 8, which makes a very big sound.
I've got to go. I'm sorry. Oh. I've mistimed the program. I'm being yelled at by the producers. Let me tell them instead, James, that the Hatpin opens at the Sydney Seymour Centre this Wednesday night, the 27th of February, and you've got to go. It's compulsory. My guests have been James Miller, creator of the Hatpin. Good on you, James. Carol Herbin, relative of the notorious John Makin, and Penny Russell, Associate Professor of History from the University of Sydney. On our next, we cross to Brazil to talk about oil theft. Then we discuss the legality of Kosovo's independence. And a clandestine theatre group speaks out about human rights abuses in a part of the old Soviet Union. That's it for now, but stick around for the news on Radio National. And the Waltz of the Wombats takes us out. And there they are, bobbing over the skyline of Sydney.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.